Hello.
Alex, good morning.
Hi. Good morning. Good morning. How
are
you?
Noontime for you, I guess.
Good noon. Good noon, yes.
Thank you for taking some time today.
No, that's fine. The time worked out very well. I just had to give up my computer to Liliana. But actually, just do I need one?
Are you speaking on a speakerphone or...
I'm not. I've got headphones on it. I'm not very clear.
It's not. It's kind of muddled
on
my end.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Just give me one second. All right. Joanne, how's this?
She's talking. That's better.
Is this better?
It's better,
right.
Yeah.
If it gets worse, then let me know and I can just use a speakerphone or something. But
okay. No, that's better. It was just a little garbled.
How
are you managing? I mean, your studio practice is so rigorous, having been away and working from... other places is it difficult?
I'm actually fairly used to it. It's not too difficult, but I think it's partly because I've always got different projects on, so I kind of tailor them accordingly. I'm now really focusing on this show in Berlin, which most of it I have to do kind of on the computer anyway. So I'm working with Richard in Poland, and I'm basically kind of putting together files for him to work on out there. And because the whole thing is really a video piece, I'm not really relying on kind of making drawings for that because I've already made them and I've photographed them, and now I'm kind of cutting them up into bits and fusing elements from different paintings. So, that works out fine, and I've got lots of papers with me so I can do drawings. I'm working on another Rolodex. I brought enough with me, and I'm fairly mobile.
Well,
it's actually working out fine.
Great. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
It was interesting as I was putting together this little Instagram show that I'm presently posting,
mm-hmm.
how many of your drawings I could have used to tell the story. I actually had to edit because I didn't want it to be so overly weighted.
Mm-hmm.
But I was talking to Liz about it, and she reminded me that almost in every instance when I put something, a show of some kind together, it always includes Gorlitsky's. It's as though you are some kind of glue in the collection. It's fascinating to me. But it makes sense when you think about your work and especially the type of work I'm selecting for the collection. So
right. This current show is to do with kind of proximity, right? It's to do with space and distance.
Uh-huh, exactly.
Right. Uh-huh.
So anyway, I just wanted to share that with you. I know people know the story of your mom and her long involvement with textiles and
mm-hmm.
your growing up in that surrounding. But I was curious as to when and how you actually began to think of yourself as an artist.
I wasn't a very good student at school, and I wasn't a particularly academic students at school, and I suppose I kind of associated myself in some ways more with the kind of, on the kind of more creative side. And I think it's actually always hard to remember quite how one's childhood kind of really evolved. I find that happens quite often now that I probably have false memory syndrome. I'm constantly telling my kids that, oh yeah, I used to be drawing all the time, but I don't actually know if that's the case because I I don't really know what parts of my memory I'm tapping into, but so this is, I can't say this for sure, but in my recollection, slightly romanticized recollection, I was drawing a lot as a kid. And I think in a way, a lot of it's just to do with the kind of milieu. So it would have been completely okay for me to be kind of, you know, sitting down drawing for hours on end, you know, as far as my mum was concerned, because she wasn't kind of, you know, she wasn't kind of driving me or my brother to more kind of academic pursuits, even though that's really where, that was really his direction. So I think it really came early on. But what I can say is that because I was constantly surrounded by textiles and embroideries, I think kind of graphic language was really, really important for me, you know, from the age of 5, 6, 7. And I do remember spending a lot of time just being completely absorbed in patterns, and kind of often they were hand embroideries and woven patterns. Sometimes they were printed. So these would have been Central Asian textiles from Uzbekistan and Afghanistan and northern Pakistan. So when I think back on it, you know, just having that material in close proximity, I mean, often because they were the applied arts, one would literally be sitting on, you know, kind of a Kashgari carpet or some other kind of, you know, embroidered pillow. But then she had collections of Russian teapots. The walls were really full. So I think it, in that respect, it's really kind of through absorption, you know, just kind of this material kind of being, you know, surrounding me. I was a kind of fairly kind of dreamy kid anyway. So those two things kind of combined, and I would just spend hours looking at forms and patterns. But I can't be very specific about dates.
And when you were drawing, were you drawing patterns, or were you drawing more narrative? Do you recall?
Well, you know, I mean, I found some kind of early books of drawings, and they were just kind of, you know, cartoons of figures. But I think I probably did start working with patterns probably when I was about 11 or 12, you know, just what we now call doodling, which is a word I don't really like very much, but that's probably what it was. I mean, and now, interestingly, it's kind of almost formalized this expression. Oh, gosh, I can't remember what it is. There's some term for people sitting down and making patterns, kind of generative patterns. You know, and I think there are even books about it and so on. But it was also slightly kind of, there was, you know, I mean, I started smoking grass when I was very, well, actually hashish when I was very, very young. I mean, way, way too young. And I think there was something about that that made me get quite into kind of these kind of fairly kind of trance-like images. And then I started taking LSD when I was probably when I was 13 or 14, which, again, I was too young. But that kind of, there's a certain kind of aesthetic associated with hallucinogenic drugs. And I think I kind of probably fell into that a little bit. So probably from the age of 11, 12, I started probably focusing more on patterns and slightly kind of hallucinogenic type imagery.
I think I saw a video somewhere of an interview of you, and you called yourself a pattern farmer.
Right. Yeah.
I thought that was great. When you found a book of your early drawings that you stumbled on, and you looked at it, were you surprised by anything that you saw?
Well, no. You know, I think these books have kind of been around. You know, my mum kind of saved these books, so it's not that I suddenly came across them. I've kind of seen them over the years, and because some of them are back in London every once in a while, and I'll pick them up. Maybe surprised by lacking in talent I was. yeah, I certainly wasn't a kind of very particularly gifted draftsman. I think I'd focused on the imaginative aspect of art quite early on, like most children do. You know, that in a sense, that's probably been the thread that I've kept going the whole, you know, as long as possible, is kind of, you know, I think in a way when you make anything, you kind of forefront one aspect of your being or your interest, and that starts to define you. So actually, pattern farming is a term, you know, I think as an artist, you kind of, you're not forced to, but you kind of inevitably come up with terms to describe the way in which you work, particularly when you have to write press releases and so on. So the pattern farmer was a bit of a kind of a conceit that described my genuine interest. But I think the other strand that's kind of really run through is kind of keeping the kind of the imaginative world alive.
When you talk about this aspect of your artistry and the as being these threads, I think about your boards that you create in your studio as a way of kind of surveying those interests.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I sometimes feel like I'm almost drowning in imagery, you know, drowning is quite a negative connotation, but I think, you know, I have boxes and boxes and boxes of papers. And, you know, honestly, that's also in large part because of my relationship with studio in India, you know, that my capacity for making it kind of expands exponentially because I'm working with other people and they're producing, you know, part of drawings or that, you know, and then I'm collecting fragments from the studio. So in a sense, what happens is that I rarely work on one piece at a time. And, you know, I think I'm kind of, again, I don't necessarily see this as in the negative sense, but there is a kind of a split persona going on that I can work with some very, very literal, figurative imagery in one moment and then completely shift towards something that's to do with, you know, purely pattern making. And often I'll be working on 10 or 12 drawings on the go. So those boards, and actually I have to say, when the first one you saw, it's actually Greenberg Van Doren. That was the first time I'd really kind of put one of those things up, and that wasn't actually on a board itself, it was just using a wall. And I think that's partly just a way of looking at things together in collections. But it's also to do with kind of taking hierarchy away. You kind of, you know, it's not like the big framed finished piece is more important than the fragment that you're working on. And I often think of it the other way around. I'm kind of often more interested in, you know, in the process and the product or all the pieces that take you on a journey. In a sense, it's still more interesting than the final destination. And I think because, you know, when you're making work, often what you finally present is the finished piece. And it's always felt to me like so much is lost in that, you know, because there's so much part of the language that gets you there that's actually kind of fundamentally of interest. So those boards of, I think I just call them studio walls, those studio walls were a way of bringing that process to public view.
Had you always done the studio walls, or was there a certain moment in time when you started to create them?
I think they've always been there. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think at least, thinking back to my first studio in New York, there was definitely I think at least 20 years, and I don't, probably around 25 years.
I see. So almost as long as you've been working with Riaz.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I probably, my focus is, when I was at art school was in I was in the sculpture department. And then I was working much more with three-dimensional objects. But drawing was still a very big part of what I was doing. But maybe I didn't kind of forefront it in the way of kind of putting lots of drawings on the walls. But I do remember going through periods where I'd either feel kind of my focus had gone on my motivation, or I was just kind of slightly floundering. And then I started actually drawing with objects from the trash can. I'll just kind of upend a trash can, or I'd upend, boxes in the studio. And I started making these very small, they were kind of like three-dimensional drawings that would fit kind of very comfortably in the palm of the hand. Mm-hmm. So again, I don't actually, in a way, differentiate too much between drawing and sculpture.
But then when you think about the Rolodexes, it's sort of the combination of both.
That's right.
Quite remarkably, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think the first one of those was in 99, I started on one of those. Mm-hmm. And I actually, looking back on it, I remember when I was at Slade, one of my tutors, a man called Ed Allington, who's a very interesting artist and very good draftsman, he was talking about how artists often have dozens and dozens of sketchbooks that we rarely look at. You finish the sketchbook and then you put it away and then you never look at it. And that really inspired me to go back to, I have boxes of notebooks, drawing books, and I started looking through them and finding kind of common threads, common themes, and sometimes I would just start redrawing works that seem more important or relevant. And at first, I was doing them on these index cards, actually lined index cards at first, and then I did them on blank index cards. And then later on, I kind of started working on the Rolodexes. So they're really kind of snapshots of various. They started off as snapshots of different notebooks I've had over the years, and it kind of reflects. And actually, the fact that they're circular is slightly kind of represents my idea about time and creativity. That, I don't think of time as a linear thing, something that moves from, the straight line, but I think of it as kind of almost like a three-dimensional spiral. You kind of come back to things often kind of 5, 6, 15, 20 years later, and maybe you see them in a slightly different way, but the imagery is still very pertinent. And that's why I don't really think of aging as, I don't think of work developing chronologically in that way. I'll still make drawings now that were really kind of resonant for me 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And the Rolodex almost starts to encapsulate that, because there are forms, and I'm working on one now, and there are forms that were really important for me 25 years ago.
Has your... You mentioned when you looked back at some of the early work, you weren't very talented and you weren't necessarily a great drawer, but it sounds like you've grown comfortable and confident, and it's an essential for you. So are you in a different place in terms of how you embrace your drawing than you might have been?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've run a couple of drawing workshops over the years, and one of the, and they're based on propositions, it's kind of So I will make a proposition to the students, and it's really a starting point for discussion. So in a sense, it doesn't even matter whether it's true or not. It's something for people to think of. So one of the first propositions is there is no such thing as a bad drawing. Because drawing has, there are probably about 7 or 8 different functions of drawing, one of them, some of them are tools. So, for example, you could be an incredible draftsman, and draw fantastic trees and dogs and people. But you might be terrible at drawing a map for someone. If someone kind of came up to you and said, "Oh, I need to go to the Dog and Duck pub. Where's that?" And you start drawing a map. Some people who are not good drawers, in the classical sense, might come up with a far, far more useful, map than someone who's a very, very good draft person who starts drawing the trees, and kind of piles of poop and whatever it is. So it really depends on the purpose, I'm far more interested in the drawings than my daughters did 5 years ago than they do now. I just find them much, much more interesting.
Right.
Because they're trying to conform to some notion of draftsmanship that I think is very kind of damaging. So for myself now, it doesn't matter to me. I think it's more about kind of the way I connect with the drawing rather than whether it's so-called good or bad. But then on the other hand, working with Indian miniature paintings, and it's probably one of the reasons I decided not to study the art myself, is I think a good miniature painting has to have a degree of perfection. And that's why it's kind of really important for me to work with Riaz. He's just such an astonishing draftsman. But I have to say, if he comes up with his own imagery, it's not, and he won't mind me saying this, but it's not that interesting. Because I think we all have limitations, and for him, kind of using the imagination and coming up with new iconography or even new kind of formal language is not his strong point, and he developed his skill by copying historical works. So in that respect, I'm very lucky that miniaturism depends on the immaculate technique which he has. But to move the tradition along, you kind of need some kind of design, I suppose a strong sense of design and imagination. So I think it really depends on, the purpose of the drawing.
When I think about you, your work, your practice, your studio, it's unlike any other artists whom I know and have come to know. There are so many elements to your practice that are different. Collaboration is such a huge part of your practice, as you just alluded to with Riaz. And so I'm interested in collaboration, what that has brought to your artistry. And you've it's a powerful tool for you. Can you just talk a little more about how you see the collaboration, the partnership? Because you do it with artisans of all kinds, whether they're woodworkers or tapestry.
That's right. I do a lot of work, obviously, with Richard in Poland, the filmmaker.
Right, the filmmaker.
I think it was Joseph Albers who had this maxim that 1 + 1 = 3, and I really believe that you get. If you think of it in terms of a human relationship of a man and a woman, and they conceive a child, and there's a third entity, so it's not it's not a one-on-one, it's the sum of its parts, but it creates a third entity. And I see that very much in collaboration, that I don't know what's going to come out of any particular project, team, projects I'm doing with Riaz or with an embroiderer. I can imagine it as well as I can, but it's always something that's quite surprising about it. So I think collaboration is really to do with this element of surprise, but it's also, just kind of pooling together skills and techniques. So when I think of, Richard is a phenomenally gifted filmmaker. He did work for the BBC, did work for Channel 4, the History Channel, all sorts of things. And he's just got this kind of ability to, in terms of pacing things and, understanding rhythm. So there's no way that I could, I could spend another 15 years studying just editing, and I just wouldn't be able to touch his level of ability. Likewise, if he doesn't have subject matter, then for whatever skills he might have in terms of editing or composing, he might not have much to apply it to. So I think it's almost inevitable for me that you bring two people together and you have a third element that neither one of them could achieve on their own. It's quite unusual in drawing, I think. People would assume that an Anish Kapoor sculpture is made by someone else. But that's quite surprising. Or even, I suppose, a Solowit. That was kind of written into his methodology. But I suppose in my way of working, it's kind of fairly unusual that something that is on paper would involve, often they involve five or six different people. But it's, sometimes I think, maybe I collaborate because I'm lazy. I think it's more than that. I think the world that I kind of, the relationship I have with Riaz, for example, is one of the most, powerful and most important relationships in my life. Not just for the work that we create together, but just in terms of my ability to kind of step into his world in India. It's such kind of privilege. Is the sound okay now?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not ideal, but it's better than it was.
Well, listen, let me... Joanne, how's this?
That's good.
Is this any better?
Yeah. Keep talking. Okay.
I think the benefits of collaboration are partly to do with the work itself, but there's another side of it, which is just to do with kind of enriching your own world. That's certainly what I've felt with working with Richard and with Riaz and with, some embroiderers and the woodworker.
Another aspect of your work that interests me is humor. You know how much I love your sense of humor and your sense of play. And oftentimes that sense of play is missing in studios. Artists are just so driven and focused. They don't take time out to relax, let go, and be more lighthearted or experiment. And so I'm interested in this aspect of what goes on in your studio as well, with the humor, where does that come from? And you seem, sense of play seems so natural to you.
Right, yeah. It's, I take play very seriously. I really do. I don't take my I take what I do very seriously. I don't take myself too seriously. You know, I think one's fallibilities and one's idiosyncrasies and one's, you know, just the gaps are really, really important. So I really, you know, I really admire people who have a very kind of austere, earnest practice. But that's for them, and it's not for me. So what I find is that actually, you know, an Instagram is kind of interesting for me, that I find you can kind of post things that are quite relevant and pertinent and, you know, on point, and then do something that completely subverts that. And that's something I value quite a lot. And in a way, it's strange talking about humor, because one can be very earnest talking about humor.
Yeah.
But I think of it actually more as playful than humorous.
Say, what's the word again?
Playful.
Oh, playful, okay.
Rather than humorous. You know, my kids don't find me very funny at all. I mean, I'm constantly telling them I am, but they don't think so. You know, thankfully, Joy still laughs at some of my jokes. But I don't know. It's weird, you know. I'm kind of pretty obsessed about art, but I don't even think art is. I don't put it on the same pedestal that many people. You know, I don't think artists deserve a break necessarily. You know, I don't think artists should be kind of seen as, you know, kind of. You know, we're incredibly lucky, and I think if you can spend your time doing what you love doing, that is a reward in itself. You know, so I don't take being an artist, you know, I take it as an incredible privilege, but I don't take it that, you know, I don't give it that kind of weight that I think other people might. And the studio is really a massive playground. You know, it's not a massive playground, but it's a 680 square foot playground for me that I feel kind of incredibly lucky to walk into every day when I had it. And even now, you know, with all my boxes of papers, you know, Joy sits down at her computer and she's really focused on helping students and developing, you know, kind of resources for them. And she's really focused on helping people in the outside world. And I get to work and I'm just kind of able to drift in and out of some kind of reverie, and I certainly don't think, you know, my, you know, what I do is in any way more important than what she does. I think it's absolutely the opposite. It's weird, because I often don't think of my work as particularly funny. But I suppose there is some whimsical side to it. Probably maybe kind of in relation to dreams, the kind of strange things happen in dreams, and they might seem humorous, but when you're dreaming them, they're quite, you know, they're often quite serious. And that's probably how I think of my work.
Well, humorous is a better word, for sure. I agree.
Right. Yeah.
And some irony.
That, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think of you as funny.
I'm glad.
I mean, your posts always make me laugh. So that's why I use the word funny.
Yeah.
I'm not necessarily referring to the work directly, but certainly.
No, I know. I know. I think that's quite.
I mean,
no,
there's always levity when you're around. I feel that. So I appreciate that very much.
Right. Well, actually, that's kind of interesting about, I think levity is quite a nice way of thinking about it, because it's just to do with something that has, you know, I think a lot about things elementally, you know, just to do with air and ether and, you know, water and fire, for example, and earth, you know, and I think the idea of air is quite important, you know, just to kind of allow people just to kind of, you know, just kind of Yeah, just to be able to drift a little bit into dreams.
Well, I think if you have a mind as active as yours, and clearly it's extraordinarily active and imaginative, without that, and you took it all so seriously, it would be overwhelming. You wouldn't be able to
cope.
So I think having that air, that levity, helps you manage everything.
I think that's right. And I'm drawn to other artists who have kind of lightness of touch as well.
So when I saw this other video that I just referred to before, it struck me, and I'd never thought about this with you before, but the many roles you play in getting your artistry out there. I mean, you are a director, you are a producer, a writer, you write the narrative. I think of your studio almost as a set for a theater. I think of it as all very theatrical.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never really kind of put that all together before. But I've been thinking a lot about that in anticipation of speaking with you today. And I wonder if you'd comment on this idea.
Yeah, I think that's very astute. I mean, I mean, also partly because, again, I'm commissioning artists. I mean, this is another thing just to do with the difference between commissioning and collaborating. But in a sense, I sometimes think of myself as an art director, I think quite a few of my most recent shows have been to do with, focusing on the installational quality with the carpets and the wallpapers and so on, and designing lights and tables, and I've been designing cutlery recently. So I think that sense of bringing different aspects together and creating a maybe a set has been a big part of it, I'm constantly kind of looking for opportunity. I'd love to design, small hotels, for example, in which, every room is different and every wall surface is different, and, designing the furniture, for example, and designing the plateware would be a real, would be quite an ideal situation. So, I think that's really true. I think just thinking about drawings or thinking about works on paper does feel slightly limiting towards me, even though that's only kind of the vast majority of the work is that.
It's so integrated into your artistry. You think of a lot of artists today are consigning with retailers, making handbags or whatever, but it's in a different context where I think with what you do, it all fits within the context of who you are as an artist and how you are as an artist. It all fits as part of the theater that you've created.
I mean, also because if someone said, well, you can go to the V&A and spend an afternoon in the lace department or the glass department, or you can spend the same amount of time going to a contemporary painting exhibition or gallery, I'd certainly choose the former. So the idea of the applied art, I was always really fascinated by the art into production movement in the Soviet Union, in the 10s and 20s, where you had kind of Rodchenko and Goncharova and, Lisitsky. They were designing teapots and they were designing clothing for the workers. Until it all got kind of limited by Stalin, they had to kind of work on social realism. But there's that period in Soviet history where things became so radical that you can design a plate and it would somehow be in service of some other ideal. But it was beautiful and it was interesting and radical. So that is the kind of construct has been really interesting for me, the idea of kind of creating spaces. I mean, my own apartment is a bit of a dump, to be honest. You know, so, you know, we have these kind of, we have these unbelievably hideous lights, you know, hanging from the ceiling. But, you know, but there, we, you know, we rent an apartment. You know, and it just strikes me, you know, if I'm so into all this, you know, into kind of designing, how come I've not done anything about that? So I don't quite understand that. It might be kind of like mechanics driving really kind of dodgy cars, or plumbers have leaky taps at home. So it's not that I've, you know, I'm slightly envious of those artists who turn their living environment into, you know, into works of art, and they, you know, and I just haven't quite managed to do that. But yeah, I think that does definitely appeal to me. The you know, kind of taking away the hierarchy away from fine art as being the most important kind of aspect of one's kind of creative cultural environment, and thinking about the wallpaper, or the carpets, or the furniture, mm-hmm. you know, the napkins, the teapots, and the plates. And again, I'm unable to do it because, you know, not, you know, because I have a studio in Jaipur, and I can tap into these skill sets that I wouldn't, I just wouldn't be able to afford to do were I working simply just in America.
I think we might need to have part two of our chat, because there are like at least 5 more questions I have here, and 45 minutes is up, and I have another call in 15 minutes.
Okay. Well,
So can we do a part two?
Absolutely. I'd be delighted.
Okay. I'll send you an email. We'll reschedule, because there's a whole other aspect of my talking with you that I'm interested to know what advice you would give to artists coming out of graduate schools. And we'll want to talk about the digital age with you, and reading, and, you know, what books have you read that were inspiring, and that sort of thing.
Okay.
So if we could maybe have another 20 or 30 minutes together, I think that would be wonderful.
I'd be delighted at any time. I mean, I've got a meeting tomorrow.
Well, it'll probably have to be next week.
Yeah, that's fine. You know,
okay.
Time, okay. We're very lucky with time these days.
Yeah, we are. That's for sure. Well, give my best to Joy and the girls who are they 13? How old are they?
They're 14. They're
14.
Yeah.
Oh, my. And whenever I think of them, I go back to Martin's booth at that fair, 14 years ago. So
wow.
I miss you, Alex. It's so good to talk
to
you.
Lovely.
Thank you.
And,
all right.
We'll
be in touch again. Okay.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.